rest of them. They sitting up there watching you. Now you get on out of here and do what you got to do. And it was vague, it was amorphous, and I went back to New York and I just didn't know what to make of this. And the more I would think about it, it obviously had to do with that story, but the story was pretty intact. That had been pretty much the same since I was a little boy. The clue, whatever it be, seemed to be in those strange phonetic sounds which had always been part of the story. Those sounds which always allegedly, they said, the African would make pointing to objects in a Virginia plantation, telling his daughter what they were. And I begin to realize now that there were hundreds of tongues spoken in Africa. And these sounds obviously were fragments of some one of those tongues. What tongue was it? Was there any way I could find out? I have a friend, a master researcher, George Sims, who knew what I was trying to do. He came up with a listing of people who in the academic world are renowned for their knowledge of African linguistics. And I looked at the little thumbnail notes on each one. And the one who intrigued me most of all was a Belgian by birth and rearing and some of his education. Then he had finished his doctoral work at the University of London School of Oriental and African Studies. And I found that this man had gone to Africa and had studied the tongues that were spoken in the villages, and with his technical expertise in linguistics, he had written a book originally in French called La Tradition Orale, The Oral Tradition. And his name was Dr. Jan Van Siener, and he was in this country at the University of Wisconsin. I got on the phone person to person, and after a while I'm talking with him. He was a little puzzled by what I was trying to convey, but he was gracious. He said he'd be happy to talk with me. And I got on a plane and flew to Madison, Wisconsin, impelled with curiosity about a few syllables, threads, fragments, shards of some African tongue, and with no dream in the world what I was really about to get into. The evening of after my arrival, I sat in the Van Siener's living room with the Dr. Van Siener and told him everything I could muster, buttressed by what Cousin Georgia more recently had told me. And he listened intently, and when it got late, he invited me to stay the night at their home, and I did. The following morning, as I look back upon it, seems like a miracle. Before breakfast, Dr. Van Siener came down, very serious expression on his face, and he said, I wanted to sleep on it. Then he told me that he had already been on the phone with colleagues of his, like the eminent Africanist Dr. Philip Curtin and others, and that they agreed that the collective sounds I had brought there were the Mandinka tongue. I'd never heard the word of it. I never heard that word. He explained to me that that was a tongue spoken by the Mandingo people. He began to guess translate. There was a sound that meant cow or cattle. Another that meant the baobab tree, generic in West Africa. He came to the sound ko. I had told him that this African allegedly would point to a stringed instrument and say ko in Virginia on a plantation. And I was told now that certainly would have been his way of reference to one of the oldest stringed instruments in the African, or in the Mandinka culture anyway, called a kora, made of a large gourd covered with goat skin, fitted with a long neck and 21 strings and a bridge, and it crudely would resemble another stringed instrument to an African. He came finally to the most involved of all the sounds which had been transferred down across the generations. I had told him, as had been the case, that in Spotsylvania County, Virginia, allegedly, this African would point to the Matapanai River and say to his daughter, Kandi Bolongo. And I was told now that in the Mandinka tongue, the word Bolongo translated to large, moving, running stream, such as a river. Preceded by the word Kandi, it very probably meant Gambia River. I had never heard of such a place. It was a work of short order for Dr. Van Siener to point out to me on a map where the Gambia was. A very long, narrow country, one of the smallest countries in all of Africa, about midway down the West African coast, jutting into Senegal, bordered on three sides by Senegal, fronting onto the ocean, and bisected by the Gambia River. And I had this tremendous compulsive urge right there. I had to get to that place. But after I spent a night thinking about it, it began to become kind of ambivalent, because I began to realize overnight, I knew next to nothing about Africa. I knew where it was on a map, but not much more than that. And I just sort of realized, you don't just pop up in Africa. And it occurred to me that I had to get somebody to help me, sort of go with me and pave the way. I went searching around among lists of the many African students in this country, even at that time. And I found that there were a very few from that tiny country called the Gambia. The one who was physically closest to me at that time was a fellow named Ibu Manga, who was attending a place I had not heard of up to that time called Hamilton College, upstate New York, Clinton, New York. I hit that campus one Thursday afternoon and practically snatched Ibu Manga out of an economics class and got us about a week later on Pan American. And we flew from there to Dakar, Senegal. There we were able to change over, and later we got a light plane that flew us to Yundum Airport that serves the Gambia. We rode in a van into the city called then Bathurst, now called Banjul, the capital city. And there he took me to his home. His father, Al-Haji Malik Manga, the people there historically are Muslim and today predominantly are Muslim. And Al-Haji Manga was most hospitable, and he got together three men whom he knew to be very knowledgeable of the history of the country. And I sat with those men in the lounge of the Little Atlantic Hotel, and I told them, as I had told Dr. Van Sina, every thread, every fragment I could recall, buttressed by what Cousin Georgia had recently told me about the story that had come down in the family. And when I got done, these Africans, it gives me to this day the quivers to reflect upon how tissue thin at times have been the hinges on which this whole adventure has swung. Because what these Africans reacted to out of the whole considerable story was two syllables. They said, now there may be significance that your forefather said his name was Kente. I said there was nothing more explicit in the whole of the story than the pronunciation of his name. And they said, well, now look here. In our country, our oldest villages tend to be named for those families, those clans, which founded and settled those villages centuries ago. And they got a little map and pointed out, look, here is the village of Kente Kunda. And not far from it, here is the village of Kente Kunda Janeya. And then they told me about something I had never heard, never dreamed existed, about how history has been kept in Africa for centuries back, about families, about clans. They told me about very old men who are called griots. It's spelled G-R-I-O-T-S. As they described griots, they seemed to be like walking, living archives. They told me about men who began in their early teens, having then been chosen for demonstrated powers of memory, and who began to study on the progressively older men who are telling the story of that family, of that clan. They told me how the teenage boy would spend maybe 40 to 50 years in training before he would be trusted to be the senior griot, who in the case of a big spreading clan might be able to talk as much as 2 days without once repeating himself, telling the centuries old history of that clan in meticulous detail. And I was just astounded to hear such a thing. And these men pointed out to me that the reason I was so astounded was, as they put it, that I came from our culture here, where, as they put it, we have become so conditioned to what they described as, quote, the crutch of print, that we have almost forgotten what the human memory is capable of, if in fact it's trained, as the case with these men. And then they told me that since the Kente clan was well known and old, and since my forefather always had insisted his name was Kente, they would see what they could do to help me. And I came back to this country enormously bewildered. I just didn't know what to think of it, to make of it. I really hadn't thought all that much about Africa. It began, the more I did think about it, to embarrass me and to make me angry with it, that I had gotten to be a grown man. And all I had really learned about the people, the culture, the history of Africa, very largely was what I had derived from Tarzan or from Jungle Jim or so forth. And I knew that wasn't the answer. Just common sense told me that, having met the people I had met in Africa. So I began now a voracious reading, everything I could lay my hands on about Africa circa that particular era of time. Weeks passed. A letter came that I should come back to the Gambia as soon as I could, and as soon as I could get the funds together and my visas and stuff again, I was off again to Africa. This time, the same men with whom I previously had talked told me, rather matter-of-factly, that the word had been put out in the provinces, as they call the back country, and that there had indeed been found a griot of the Kente clan. When I heard there was such a man, I was ready to have a fit. Like, where is he? I would have figured my experience here in American Magazine, rather, the government should have had him there with a public relations man for me to talk to. And they looked at me oddly, and they said, he's in his village. And I discovered at that point that if I was to see this man whom I so desperately wanted to see, I was going to have to do something I had never dreamed would fall my lot. I'd read about it, heard about it, had seen it on newsreels and television, but never dreamed I ever would have to organize a modified safari. It took me 3 days to rent a launch to get up river, a lorry, a Land Rover to take supplies by a roundabout land route, to hire finally a total of 14 people, 3 interpreters, one each, able in the Mandinka, the Jola, and the Wolof tongues that they said we would meet along the way, to hire 4 musicians, because they told me in the back country these old men would not talk without music in the background, and so forth. And on the 4th day, we went vibrating up the Gambia River in a little lodge called the Badibou. We got up to a village called El Brita on the left bank going upriver, and we went ashore there, and the destination now by foot was a village called Jufere. There is an expression called the peak experience. It is that which emotionally nothing in your life ever will transcend, and I feel very certain I had mine that first day in backcountry Black West Africa. When we got up proximate to the village of Jufere, I should tell you the villages in the back country look very much today as they did 200 years ago. They're circular, mud-walled little houses with the conical thatched roofs. And as we got up closer, the people came hurrying out. Jufere is a very small village, only about 70 adults. Among the people, there was a man compactly built, an off-white robe, a kind of pillbox hat, and somehow I knew that was the man we'd come to see. There was some aura of somebody-ness about him. And sure enough, the interpreters with me went to him. And meanwhile, the other people came quickly filtering around me. They were a kind of a horseshoe design. Had I held out my hands like that at arm's length, I would have touched the nearest ones on either side. They were about 3-4 deep all around. And I began to feel very discomforted. And I began to realize why I was so discomforted was because of the intensity of their staring at me. The eyes just raked from head to foot. The foreheads were furrowed in the intensity of staring. And then I began to have another feeling. It was much more agitated. It was visceral. My insides began to feel as if they would churn around. I felt almost nauseous. Now, I remember standing up sort of thinking to myself, what in the world is the matter with you? And what came to me was a realization, all of a sudden, that for the first time in my life, I was in a crowd, and I was the only one of my color, which might be said to be brown. That everybody else there was just black as soot. And that thing hit me emotionally like a thunderbolt. To this day, I don't know all the components of why it did. But you know how it's kind of body English? If we are insecure, ill at ease, we'll tend to drop our glances. And I found myself, without having intended to do it, looking down at my own hands, my own complexion, naturally in contrast with their complexion. Then I began to have this almost like a gale force wind blow of terrible feeling, as if I were hybrid, as if I were impure among the pure. And it was just awful. And about that time, the old man left the interpreters. He walked away, and the people as quickly left me and went to him. And one of the interpreters came up to me. His name was Salah, and he whispered in my ear, and what he whispered, when I understood its import, made me feel that I would make me realize something I never had before, and that was, he said, why they stare at you so, they have never here seen a black American. And I suddenly realized they were not looking at me as Alex Haley, individual writer, as I tend to think of myself, but they were seeing me through their eyes and for their purposes as the symbol of all the 25 plus millions of black people in this country whom they never had seen. And it was just awesome to realize that someone had imputed to you that enormity of symbolism. And I was standing there kind of rocked by that, and I became now aware of how the people had clustered around the old man, and they were all talking animatedly, flicking glances at me. Though I couldn't understand a syllable of Mandinka, there was a universality of language, of gestures, nuances, inflections, and somehow I knew exactly what they were trying to, talking about. I knew they were trying to arrive at how did they collectively feel about me symbolizing to them all we black people in this country whom they never had seen. And there came a moment when the old man turned. He walked right through the people. He walked right past three interpreters. He came, he stood probably that close to me, his eyes piercing into mine. He spoke to me in Mandinka as if he felt instinctively I ought to be able to understand it, which of course I couldn't, and the translation came from his side. And ever since I heard and understood the meaning of that translation, the significances of it, I have vowed that as soon as I get this book and the film all kind of settled down somewhat more, I am going to see these words put in some permanent way, appropriately located along the southern coast of the United States and the western coast of Africa, the way they had decided, they felt, about me symbolizing to them all we black peoples by the millions and millions in this country. And what they said, or he said for them, was, yes, we have been told by the forefathers that there are many of us from this place who are in exile in that place called America and in other places. And that was the way they saw it. The old man began to talk now, the griot. His name was Keba Kanga Fofana. He had 73 reigns, which is to say 73 years of age, one rainy season a year. And I should tell you that one of the most awesome things I have since come to try and deal with is that if, and this particular if should be a letter 6 feet high because it so rarely is possible because of intervening occurrences, nevertheless, if any black person in this audience, if any black person in this country only could know a few vital clues, if one could only know what was the actual African name of the ancestor or ancestors brought out of Africa, if one could know where were they brought from and about when were they brought out, that to this day it is not impossible that the contemporary black American could be put into contact with a certain griot in some way in backcountry black West Africa who could tell the contemporary black American literally the ancestral clan from whence he or she sprang, if they could know those clues which are almost impossible to know. I was being blessed to hear such a story because through a succession of miracles I had been able to come there with a collection of really little more than syllables. I should tell you, when a griot talks, it's a state occasion within the village, no matter how many times the family story has been told. The people gather in a wide semicircle. They stand in a posture that might sort of loosely be described as something like parade rest, and the griot talks. And he bends forward, his torso rigid, the cords stand out in his neck, and when he speaks, it's rather as if words are coming off a scroll. Working through an interpreter, as this one was, he'd go 3-4 sentences, stop, translation would come. After about 15 minutes of that experience, I was absolutely astounded at the incredible array of lineage coming out of this man's memory through his mouth. 200 years ago, who married whom? What children in what order, all the way across the family line? Drop down to the children, each of them, whom they married, their children in what order. It was just unbelievable. And every now and then, I was struck all the time about how they would describe it, how it was interpreted. The biblical way they expressed themselves, it would be something like, and so took as a wife so, and begot, and thus the children were named. And every now and then, when he told about the children, he would stop and he would tell some little tangential thing about this or that or the other begot as that person grew older and something happened to him. It might be something like in the year of the big water, he slew a water buffalo or something like that. I remember once kind of smirking at hearing that, and one of the interpreters firmly told me that although it might have been a century or some ago, if a man brought into a hungry village a water buffalo, that he deserved to be and he was chronicled forever in the history of that village. Anyway, I was privileged that day to hear hours of the Kente clan story, my forebear having always insisted his name was Kente. I can strip out of it the essence of it in just a couple of minutes, and again with a reminder that the equivalent, the counterpart of it, exists this day somewhere in backcountry Black West Africa for every black person who is present here or who is in this country, if she or he only could know the clues to get to the right Rio. He told me that the Kente clan had been begun in a country called Old Mali. The men of the clan predominantly were blacksmiths who conquered fire, was the way they phrased it. The women were potters and weavers. A branch of their clan had moved into the country called Mauritania, and without of Mauritania, they had come one son of the clan. His name was Kareba Kunta Kente. He was a Marabu of the Muslim religion. The people in that section, I have said, historically were Muslim. He was a holy man, Marabu. As a young Marabu holy man, he went out of Mauritania down to the little narrow country called the Gambia. He stopped first in a village called Pakalinding, and thence he went to a village called Jifarong, and from there to a village called Jufere. It was in the village of Jufere he took his first wife, a Mandinka maiden, her name Cyrene, and by her he begot two sons, whose names were Jane and Saloon. Then, Muslim man, plural wise, he took a second wife. Her name was Yesa, and by Yesa he begot a son whose name was Omero. The three sons grew up in that village, and they, as the older two became of age, they went away and founded a new village called Kente Kunda Janaya. Then the youngest of them, Omero, stayed there until he had 30 reigns, and then he took a wife, a Mandinka maiden whose name was Bita Keba. And by Bita Keba, within the decade that we on our calendar system roughly would call, or loosely would call, between 1750 and 1760, in that decade, Omero Kente begot by Bita Keba Kente four sons, who in the order of their arrivals would be named Kunta, Lamine, Siwadu, and Madi. The old man, the griot, had been talking for some hours when he got to that level of the family account. Then, as he had stopped scores of times earlier to tell some little something or other about this or that or the other person whom he had named earlier, he also now told another tangential thing, and translation came from me, to me, and it began about the time the king's soldiers came. And that was the way they date things. They don't use dates as we do, they use events. Anyway, in backcountry Black West Africa, the Gambia, I am hearing told to me the story of the Kentes, because my forefather always had insisted his name was Kente, and what I heard now was, about the time the king's soldiers came, the eldest of these four brothers, Kunta, went away from this village to chop wood, and he was never seen again. And the man went on with his story. Well, I sat there as if I was carved of rock. There was no way in the world for him to know what he had said to me. It was physical effort. I took physical effort for me to get my hands into my duffel bag, get out my notebook. The early pages contained a synthesis of what had been told on a West Tennessee front porch by Grandma, Aunt Liz, Aunt Plus, Aunt Vinnie, and all the rest of them talking when I was a little boy, about this African forefather who always in Virginia had insisted his name was Kente, and who always had said he had been chopping wood to make a drum when he'd been surprised, set upon, and captured. As I beckoned to the interpreter Salah, he came over, and in a kind of dazed way, I watched him read, and I watched him begin to perceive and to become agitated. He went to the old man, who got more agitated than he, and the old man all but snatched my book, and jabbing his narrow fingers at his pages, talked very rapidly to the people. I remember I'd been sitting on a little three-legged stool with a cowhide top, and I felt rather as if I'd been pumped full of helium. I just popped up like a jack-in-the-box. And I don't remember anyone giving an order. I just remember becoming aware that the people had formed a circle around me. They were chanting something. Their voices loud, soft. They were moving counterclockwise. And I remember I was standing right in the middle of them, just wiped out. I didn't know how to feel. How could you feel? And I remember I happened to be looking right toward the face of one of the about a dozen ladies in that circle who had little infants flung over their back the way they carried them in those claws. As this lady with a fierce scowl on the Shinola black face broke from that circle and came charging in toward me, her bare feet kicking up little puffs of dust, and she took her infant and all but roughly thrust it out, the gesture saying, take it. And I took it and clasped it the way we instinctively do babies. Whereupon she all but jerked it away. There stood another lady offering her baby. And I guess I was the next couple of minutes clasping those babies. I would be back in this country, speaking at Harvard University, when a very famous scholar in this country who knows of such things, Dr. Jerome Bruner, said to me, you were participating in, and you did not know it, one of the oldest ceremonies of humankind called the laying on of hands. That in their way, they were saying to you, through this flesh, which is us, we are you and you are us. And there were many, many other things extremely emotional that day in that village. The one that got to me, I guess, after that most was the people, the men, took me to their mosque. And they wanted to take me and tell me, show me how they worship. I was very struck by the fact, I'm Methodist, they were Muslim, I didn't know what to do. And I was on my knees and they were praying around me. And I remember thinking, I found out where I've come from and I don't even understand what they're saying. And then it came that I wanted to leave. I just couldn't handle it anymore emotionally. I went out with a driver in a Land Rover and we were going out backcountry black West Africa with the foliage is unbelievable, the streaking parrots that come down in brilliant bursts of green and almost land on you in a Land Rover. The sounds, the sights, the monkeys and all that. And my head was just full of the way that the people had been brought out of those villages back during the taking of them as slaves. The way that people's thatched roof would fall in on them at night. And the way that they were caught in the carnages outside at night, and they were put in neck containers called coffles. It is said that some coffles of slaves were as much as a mile in length. And then there would be this torturous march down to where the ships were, and there were the barracoons where they would be fed and watered until they got back in some kind of shape. And then they would be examined by the captains and mates of the ships, and then they would be haggled over for price. And those purchased would generally be branded between the shoulder blades, usually with the initials of the ship that was going to take them out. And what I could see now, sort of in my mind's eye, was something I'd read in so many places, was that it seemed that those Africans really didn't react until they were being led across that strip of beach. And it was there that for the first time they seemed to perceive what was about to happen, the enormity of the unknown. That they would scream, they'd go into spasms, they would fall prone, they would use their fingers like claws in the sand, they would use their necks and tails like the beaks of giant birds, trying to bite up one last choking mouthful of the land that was their own. But they were beaten from that into the canoes at the water's edge, which took them out to the ships on the deeper water. And that was how every ancestor of all the black people in this country were brought. There was no exception. And my head was just full of that when we got to a big, big village up ahead. And I saw the people milling in the road and waving, crying out something. And I knew they'd heard what had happened in Duvalier. Somebody had come out while I was still there and brought the word. And as we came up to those people, the driver had to slow down to about 2 miles an hour. And as he was nudging his way through the crowd, and I'm standing up in the Land Rover looking down at these people, jet black, the old men, the elders, the grandmothers with breasts like bell straps, the childbearing mothers, many of them very pregnant, the maidens, the youth, the little tarred black naked youngsters, both sexes, all were waving up at me, beaming brilliant expressions on their faces. And what they were crying out, I suddenly realized, was, Mr. Kente, Mr. Kente. And I tell you what, I am a man, but I remember when a sob hit me about ankle level and surged up, and I remember flinging my hands up to my face and shrieking, crying. I don't think I've cried like that since I was a little boy. It just seemed to me that if one really knew the story of how black people had come here, that one simply as a human being ought to weep that that thing called slavery had ever happened in the annals of human beings. I got back to New York took me a while to get together, and I went to the publisher and told him what had happened. And I told him that I felt I needed to write a book. It would be titled Roots. It would be the story technically of my family, but actually, it would be the saga of a people. The reason it was that was because we, more than any other people that I know of on earth, certainly of such number, have the greatest common denominator of ancestral background that every black person, it does not matter who he or she is, ancestrally traces back to some African born and reared in some one of those villages, captured in some way, put into some slave ship, brought across the same ocean, into some succession of plantations up to the Civil War, the emancipation, and from that day to this struggle for freedom. And that was what really launched me into what has subsequently been 9 years of research, then 3 years of writing, to produce the book Roots that you now know about. I'm happy I can say, not in any praising me way at all, but simply in a reporting way, because I'm as awed about it as anybody could be, that the book has now, inside of less than 6 months, as I understand, has now sold something in excess of 1.5 million copies in this country. It is going to be a worldwide book because at this time it is being translated into 18 foreign languages, so it will be read worldwide. And it seems to me that there are lots of things that are said, I hope not just in Roots, but in things related to Roots, that might have some meaning to all people, not just black people, but other people of various ethnic derivations who seem to be as strongly responsive to Roots as black people are. Somehow to me, the potential for us all, collectively, seems to be summed up in one of the things that I found so moving to me out of that African culture that I went into at great length to weave it around the life of the little boy Kunta growing up in that village. And that was how those babies were named, and in those communities where those people lived who we all grew up to regard from things we heard as savages and heathens. That every time a baby was born, the father would not be seen much for the next 7 days because he was occupied with thinking up a good meaningful name for the baby. On the 8th day of that baby's life, the people of the village would gather. They brought with them the village alamamo, like a minister in our culture, the village jalaba, a drummer, who for this occasion brought a small drum called a tentang. And now they would come there and the drummer would give a roll on the drum and the people would come rigidly to attention. A second roll on the drum, the mother would step out and sit on a little stool provided for her. A third roll on the drum, and the alamamo minister would give a blessing upon the congregation, these being these heathens and savages we've heard so much about. The fourth roll on the drum, the father would come out of the bush where he kept himself, and he would walk over with every eye on him to where his wife, the mother, sat holding this little black 8-day-old infant. And he would lift up that infant, and bear in mind the infants are the ancestors of we black people in this country. And he'd lift that infant up with everybody watching and turn it so one of its tiny ears was very close to his lips. And into that ear, this father would whisper the name he had selected 3 times. And the thinking of these alleged heathen savage people in doing it that way was that the individual thus named always obviously would be the first to know who he was. And I would close on this note that seems to me to be really the heart of the symbol of the potentials for all of us, whatever our extracting ethnically, that night the father now alone would take his infant out a distance from the village. And he would hold that infant, 8 months old, up so that it looked up at the moon and the stars, the firmament. And he would speak to it. That was translated again to the potential for us here in this country. Behold the only thing greater than thyself. I've talked over. Thank you.